I began to sort of search for ways to heal myself. I was having bloating and pain and skin problems and joint problems and chronic pain, and I was very unhappy and physically exhausted all the time. Because I'd seen lots of doctors and I'd seen all these different specialists and no one could tell me what was wrong with me. And I started to learn about food and the power of nutrition, but also the damage the food system is having to our world. And then I watched Earthlings, and that film completely changed the way I viewed animals. But after watching Earthlings helped me understand and see the damage we're doing to the lives of these beings, and helped me understand that animals are individuals, that they are not just objects for us to chop into pieces and serve on a plate. And so when I looked at a steak or a drumstick, I no longer saw just a steak or drumstick. I saw a cow or a chicken. And I looked at her and she looked at me, and I could feel her pain. I could sense her pain. She was terrified. Her eyes were shaking, her body was shaking, and she was dying. And I couldn't do it. And, you know, I had this spiritual, religious moment, you could say, where I switched places with her. I became her, she became me. My blood was her blood, my eyes were her eyes, and I felt the life slipping from her body. And, you know, when I held her in my hands, I looked at her, I had this realization. All the things that I'd learnt about and had been said to me in the script of Earthlings really touched a part of me and opened a part of me. And at that point I decided I'd never eat animals again, and that I would never pay someone else to harm an animal knowingly. I guess that's when I officially became a vegan. People like to hear good things about their bad habits. If people haven't switched to a plant-based diet, they haven't read the studies yet. The data is there. There's enough concrete evidence to prove that a whole food plant-based diet will stop and reverse the leading killers of human beings in the world today.
This is Conversations with Changemakers with me, your host, Gary Tirola. Every week I bring you an inspiring leader that is rethinking what it means to be a changemaker. During these conversations, I slowly peel back the layers of the minds of our future leaders that are using their skills to positively impact this world. What's up, listeners? Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Changemakers. I'm coming to you from my soul food land, the island of the gods, Bali, Canggu. It's amazing. And I'm with a very dear friend and incredible changemaker himself, Robbie Lucky. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Of course. So those of you that don't know, Robbie Lucky is the founder and co-founder and creative brains behind Plant Based News, as well as a genuine awesome guy and activist, vegan activist in his own right. But been following him for a while now, and I believe you're way more than just a vegan activist. You speak up for what is right in all spheres, which is great. And I love the way you deliver your message. It's not too much of the angry vegan message. but yeah, so let's jump into it. How long has plant-based news been going on for now?
So it started out as a YouTube channel back in 2015. And the kind of purpose of it was to kind of tell the story of the plant-based movement, everything that was going on. And it kind of acted a bit like a kind of mini CNN.
Yeah.
People would read the news and tell the stories of the plant-based innovations and things that were going on around the world, law changes or animal rights breakthroughs or whatever. And then in 2016, I think it was, Klaus Mitchell, who's a good friend of mine, we met each other at an event called Vegan Futures, which is a bit like a TED Talks for vegans.
In London.
Okay. And we met each other. We got on quite well. He ended up living up the road from me, helped me move into my house. And we just became really good friends. And we were hanging out, and he'd come over. And he said, you know, do you want to help me develop this platform? Well, he was, at the time, it was a YouTube channel. He was like, do you want to help me develop this and work on it? And I said, sure, why not? You know, I was working in the corporate world and the advertising industry, and I wanted something, you know, that I believed in to sort of like work on. And so I developed the website and took over the social media, and we just were having fun with it. And then in 2017, we got an email from a guy called Prince Khaled Al-Waleed, aka the Vegan Prince, the original Vegan Prince. And he sent us an email, and he said, I really love what you're doing, and I want to help you guys, and not just with money. And we were like, oh, okay. We didn't know who he was. And so we looked him up and realized that he was, you know, he was a real deal. He was a really like influential person. We replied and he came back straight away. And his message to us was, you know, thank you for your reply. I'm really impressed that you didn't ask me for money. And, you know, because I wasn't thinking about money. I just was amazed. I was blown away that this guy, the Saudi Arabian prince, had even noticed what we were doing and that he was vegan as well.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah. And he said, well, you know, I really love what you're doing and I want you to be able to continue to do this and I want to be able to support you. So send me a proposal of what you want. So Klaus and I stayed up all night till like 6 a.m. working on this proposal, three-tiered approach, middle, you know, lower sort of like... bracket, which would be, you know, just us working. Middle bracket, which is us and a small team, and then the dream team, which is like a team of 20 people.
Yeah,
you know, worth like X million or something a year. And we didn't sleep the next day at like 11 a.m. half asleep. We presented to him.
Yeah,
and he loved it. He was like, great, let's do it. And he gave us money. He bought a third of our company. Which was incredible at the time because, you know, we didn't really have much of an audience. Our website was getting about 2,000 visitors a month at the time.
In 2017.
Okay. Now we're getting almost 2 million visitors a month.
That's incredible. Yeah. So the growth from 2015 to 2017, you gained 2,000 visitors a month. I know how hard it is to get people on a website.
Yeah.
Your YouTube channel, did you have substantial numbers on that already?
It was doing quite well. We're doing some really good stuff on there. But it didn't have the momentum that it does now. I think we're almost at 400,000 subscribers on YouTube.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So what was the catalyst? What was the difference with what you guys were doing in 2015, 16, and 17 to when Khaled came on board? And
the difference was is that we quit our jobs.
Okay. So you had the means to quit your jobs.
He said, I want you to quit your jobs and focus on this full time. So I went from focusing on it in the evenings and the weekends to days, evenings, weekends, every day, all day.
Okay. So it just goes to show how much the energy we put into a project really can turn it from 2,000 to 2 million clicks, visitors per month.
Yeah. And a team as well. So we have Giuseppe Federici who helps me. He's kind of my digital marketing and sales assistant. And does a lot of our scheduling and social media planning with me. And then we have Maria Carando, who is our editor. She writes all our articles. Liam, who is assistant or associate editor. Klaus, obviously, who is this editorial director, who plans most of the content into YouTube. And then who else have we got? We've got Rob, who's a part-time designer. So we've got a team of about 4.5, 5 people, maybe.
That's beautiful. So you're not at the dream team level
just yet.
But I mean, it's inevitable. Where the world is going. And
I have no idea how the hell to get there. It's a bit scary to think about having a team of 20 people.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Managing all of that and juggling all the finances of that. I really find it challenging. So adding 20 more people.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's managing employees is a job on its own. Mm. So... I take my hat off to you, but what I do applaud is how you have got to the stage you're at by just starting a little YouTube channel and the influence that you're having on the world or PBN as a whole. It really is. I mean, there is not a day that I don't see some PBN content somewhere.
That's great.
And it's
so
good.
Like it.
I know, it's so good. So... I want to go back to your life in the beginnings. You obviously weren't born a vegan.
No. Absolute opposite.
Absolute. So I want to hear your story. The brief story of Robbie, of how you grew up and how come you went vegan. Mm.
Well, okay. So we'll have to condense 40 years into 4 minutes. Let's do a decade a minute. So I was born to a young family in Rhodesia in Africa. Rhodesia is the former name of Zimbabwe. And grew up on a very small farm in the eastern highlands of Zimbabwe. And it was growing up in Africa as a white person can be quite a privileged opportunity. You know, a lot of white families do have a privileged life there. And it was like not something I took for granted. But I think when I came to England and lived in a very tiny flat and had very little going back to Africa after 6 years of being away. It was a huge shock and made me realize just the kind of privileged life that I did live. Mm. And that I did take a lot of things that I grew up with for granted, living in a country where, you know, you could travel whenever you wanted and you were free to move around wherever you wanted. And just the freedom and the space. Whereas in England, it's the opposite. It's very confined. It's very expensive. It's hard to do the things you want to do without a lot of money. You can't afford your own home. Mm. So there was a stark difference. And I spent, it's been in England 22 years now. That flew by really, really quickly. I didn't really anticipate staying in England so long. I actually went just to escape the violence that was going on in Zimbabwe at the time. There was sort of police riots and food shortages and fuel shortages. And my parents put me on a plane. I had £200 in my pocket, a couple of clothes, a couple of CDs, some family photos, and that's all I had. And off I went. Arrived in England in 1999, and I was absolutely terrified. Stayed with a cousin in Reading and then moved to London a year later because I suddenly thought, Reading's too small. I need a big city.
Yeah.
And I worked my way into the advertising world. I had no qualifications, no university experience or anything, but I always wanted to work in advertising. I always wanted to be, you know, a big shot graphic designer. And I did it, and I got into all the biggest agencies in the world. I worked in all kinds of different on different products and services. I worked for Jamie Oliver, I worked for Getty Images, I worked for BMW, I worked for lots of big brands, and it wasn't what I was expecting it to be. Mm. In the end, it became a very mundane and quite unhappy existence because there was so much pressure and so much demand. You know, I paid very well, I had a very good salary. And I did lots of different things. I had lots of different experiences trying to find something that I could do, that I could pour my heart and soul into. Before Plant-Based News, actually, I started something called People of London, which is a bit like Humans of New York. And it actually mm-hmm. predates Humans of New York, where my partner Lewis and I, we went and filmed short video portraits of people about their lives, incredible people, artists, dancers, musicians, biologists, and talked to them and went inside where they worked, and I'll show you some of them. I'm quite proud of what we created.
Is that still going?
It is still there. No, it's not going. It's kind of dormant.
Okay.
Yeah, no time now with plant-based news.
Of course.
Going back sort of 6.5-7 years ago, I was experiencing a lot of health problems, and you know, I began to sort of search for ways to heal myself. I was having bloating and pain and skin problems and joint problems and chronic pain, and I was very unhappy and physically exhausted all the time. And I read books about adrenal fatigue, and I read books about the alkaline diet. Because I'd seen lots of doctors and I'd seen all these different specialists, and no one could tell me what was wrong with me. Some people thought fibromyalgia, some people thought some kind of chronic fatigue syndrome. And I started to experiment with green juicing and essentially having more plants in my diet. I watched Netflix appeared, and I watched Food Inc. and Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead by Joe Cross, Forks Over Knives, and all these different wonderful Veggiecated. And I started to learn about food and the power of nutrition, but also the damage the food system is having to our world. And then I watched Earthlings. And that film completely changed the way I viewed animals. I always loved animals. I had pets as a child, had rats and cats and dogs and geese and all these different animals.
Zoo.
Yeah, I had a whole zoo of animals around me, and I loved them. But I never really thought about eating them the way I think about them now.
Mm.
But after watching Earthlings helped me understand and see the damage we're doing to the lives of these beings, and helped me understand that animals are individuals, that they are not just objects for us to chop into pieces and serve on a plate. And so when I looked at a steak or a drumstick, I no longer saw just a steak or drumstick. I saw a cow or a chicken.
Mm.
But around the time that I watched the film, I was at home. I think it was a Sunday afternoon. I can't remember what the day it was, but it's a very clear moment because it was so strong. And I went out. I was out in the garden, and I heard like shouts and screams in the front of the house. And I ran outside the house, and our next door neighbor was in her kind of people carrier, and she was a few paces down the road. And she was crying and screaming, and the kids were crying. Her kids were crying and screaming in the back. And I looked over to the other side, and there was the cat from next door. This beautiful white Persian cat was on the floor, flapping around in a giant pool of blood. And she'd obviously hit hit the cat with her car. And I ran over and I just remember looking down on the tarmac, and there was this huge pool of ruby red blood, kind of so dark. And the cat was flapping around and her fur was, you know, literally soaked in this bright red blood. And I picked her up, and, you know, as people always say, if an animal is suffering, you should put it out of its misery. And I looked at her and she looked at me, and I could feel her pain. I could sense her pain. She was terrified. Her eyes were shaking. Her body was shaking, and she was dying. And I couldn't do it. And, you know, I had this spiritual, religious moment, you could say, where I switched places with her. I became her. She became me. My blood was her blood. My eyes were her eyes. And I felt the life slipping from her body. And, you know, when I held her in my hands and looked at her, I had this realization. All the things that I'd learnt about and had been said to me in the script of Earthlings really touched a part of me and opened a part of me. And at that point, I decided I'd never eat animals again, and that I would never pay someone else to harm an animal knowingly. I guess that's when I officially became a vegan.
Wow, that's a... I get goosebumps just thinking of that story. They say the teacher appears when the student is ready. And that cat was definitely your teacher in that moment.
Definitely. And also my cat Nala as well, who's thankfully still alive. Having her in my life has taught me about the individuality of animals and the personality of animals, that they are unique, each of them, just like us. And they have a right to live just like we do. And that we'd have no right to take their lives unnecessarily.
Of course. I want to get back to the animals, leave the best for last. But I just want to go back to your health. I don't want to skim over that. Because a lot of people don't relate with animals as much, but they do relate with their health a lot more. I mean, you can see in Bali, there's gyms everywhere, and there's diets everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. The doctors back then, did they diagnose you with anything particularly, or did it just disappear with you going plant-based?
The doctors didn't diagnose me with anything. I had so many aches and pains and bloating and skin issues. I think a few months before we started experimenting with plants, I had this huge rash all over my body, which someone said may have been a viral rash. We don't really know. I was exhausted by 10 o'clock every night. I couldn't go out. I couldn't do anything. I had this constant aches and pains in all my joints. And I saw loads of different people, and nobody could tell me what was wrong. And I saw Chinese doctors, and I had acupuncture, and I had physiotherapy, and I had osteopathy, and I went to nutritionists and dietitians, and no one could tell me what was wrong with me. I did a before the incident with the cat, I think we did a 7-day, five or seven-day juice fast, I can remember. And we'd had five different juices every day. And it was then I started to realize that this was potentially what I was eating was causing my health problems, because within that 5-day period, I felt amazing. I started to feel better. I woke up in the morning, I didn't feel so exhausted. I felt better towards the nighttime. But actually, at the end of the juice fast, I went to a friend's birthday party and had a beef burger.
Okay.
which afterwards I felt disgusting. It was fatty and salty and oily and greasy.
That's what I was going to say. Did it make you feel worse? It
made me feel worse, yeah. And I think that was the beginning of the end of my relationship with meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. So for listeners out there, so you understand what's going on in Claire and my life, we're busy doing a detoxification with a doctor, which basically means fasting and juice. And the funny thing is understanding the detoxification needs of the body, just because of the world we live in nowadays. I think in the last 100 years, I mean, the world has tripled in population, pollution, etc. We take it lightly what we are consuming, like subconsciously, like when we're just walking around, and then obviously food. And food's a big one. And your transition to a plant-based diet, you would have seen benefits very quickly, I'm guessing.
I did. And I'm personally, I don't like to say detoxify, I like to say nourish.
Yeah.
Because I think that the body does naturally detoxify itself. But I think what happens is that the foods we eat, take dairy, for example, cause inflammation, which in a way causes like swelling, and it causes certain organs and elements of the body not to work efficiently. Take the arteries, for example. When I started having those green juices, I think, you know, when I was just having like kale juices, they're packed with nitrates, and they flush your arteries. Mm. They literally open up your arteries and all that. And I guess you could call it a toxin, I guess, if you wanted to. Those plaques and those things that stick to the edges of your arteries, the animal products we used to eat, the animal fats and refined oils, you know, yeah, maybe you are clearing it out and detoxifying it. But I think it should be a focus of nourishing our body with living foods. Foods, if you compare what a piece of flesh is to a kale and apple and carrot and ginger smoothie, you know, one is actual death and the other is life. It's living cells that are full of phytonutrients and antioxidants and things that actually help grab onto those free radicals that are damaging your cells and drag them out of your body.
100%. What do they say in the classics? Death begets death, life begets life. Mm. And this is what I try and explain to so many people, so many clients all the time is if you simplify life, and you look at diet and you're just like, what is alive? What looks lively? What is colorful? Mm. Like these types of foods are going to make you feel the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the greens vibrant. And the reds and everything. Like if you ask a kid, like, what are you going to eat between an apple and a bunny rabbit? And the bunny rabbit's live, of course. Like kid's going to choose fruits all day long. Mm. And I think we get too complicated, especially with the science out there. And it's sad because we've skipped over. It's okay to get complicated if you are a scientist and you understand the simple part of life.
Yeah.
But most people don't understand the simple part of life.
No, they don't.
Which is...
And most people are overwhelmed with conflicting information. Yeah. Internet is awash with stories that say, eat meat, don't eat meat. Mm. Eat cheese, don't eat cheese. Butter is back, said the cover of Times. Yeah. 10 years ago, you know, bacon is back. We should be eating bacon, they said the other day on This Morning TV, because apparently saturated fat isn't as damaging to the body as they thought, said an industry-funded study.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. The information fatigue that people experience.
Yeah.
I don't blame people for being confused. Now, for being someone in the industry, in the media industry, and has been for long, how do you counteract this obvious problem, this information fatigue, as a media outlet?
I mean, we counteract it by sticking to the point and not droning on for thousands and thousands of words about things. I think most of our audience are millennials, which are people who I would say on the most part have attention deficit disorder through being oversaturated with media and content. We use memes to kind of succinctly and simply explain things. Our articles are up to 1,000 words. We tend to not go over that. We make very short 3 to 4 minute videos getting to the point. Why shouldn't you eat butter? Why is saturated fat bad? Do carbs make you fat? You know, why is fiber important? Simple and to the point. So easy for people to share. And we make it fun and cool and colorful. We're not doctors and nutritionists and scientists. A lot of people who work in these industries are very dry and God bless them, dull in the sense that the way they communicate isn't very enticing and exciting. And this has been the problem up until now. These industries or these people and these groups haven't had the means to communicate the science in a way that is interesting and fun to young people. Mm. So my vision is to always communicate in a way that is vibrant and interesting.
And all the information that PBN is putting forth out there to the public, are you consulting in-house doctors, nutritionists, etc., or are you just going on research paper?
No, we work with PCRM, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We work with UK health professionals, plant-based health professionals. We work very closely with many different plant-based and vegan doctors. So we have all the experience and expertise at on hand at any time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now to ask something the critics might ask. Mm. They say, well, if you're getting your information from vegan doctors or from vegan sources, is this not bias? Are we not seeing the whole picture?
For the most part, they aren't vegan doctors. They're doctors that support a plant-based diet. So they're not vegan for the animals. They're not actually vegan activists. Mm. They're plant-based because of the science. Dr. Garth Davis, for example, he's plant-based because of what he's read in the studies and his personal experience as a cardiologist. Dr. Kim Williams, who was the director of cardiology in the USA, he said, you know, if people haven't switched to a plant-based diet, they haven't read the studies yet. The data is there. There's enough concrete evidence to prove that a whole food plant-based diet will stop and reverse the leading killers of human beings in the world today. So these people aren't making their decisions based on emotional ethics. It's based on data and on peer-reviewed studies and science. Yeah.
I knew that. I just wanted to say it. And I think this diet hole has just like exploded open, especially with Game Changers coming out. It's a fantastic movie by Jamie Wilkes. Obviously, but Joe Rogan brought it up to light. I think it was great to hear Chris Cresson first. I think it was meant to be how it panned out. Because at the end of the day, it was embarrassing for Chris. Jamie came out and really cited and went deeper in the research behind it. And I don't know what your feelings are behind Game Changers and the conversation.
Yeah, I've been dying to talk about this. So there was a 4-hour, to set the scene, obviously, we have Joe Rogan, who's this shock jock, American, you could say he's a radio host. He has a podcast called The Joe Rogan Experience, where he interviews all kinds of interesting people from all over the world. He's a very intelligent man.
Biggest podcast in the world.
Yeah, he's a very intelligent man. But he's a big meat lover. He loves to pick on vegans on a daily basis, with the butt of his jokes. But he's ultimately not a bad person. Like he's a comedian. He's funny. He draws in millions. And then you had a guy called Chris Cresso, who, let's get this straight, he's not a doctor. He's not a nutritionist. He is not an expert in anything other than maybe acupuncture. That's it. But he has decided to fashion himself as some kind of nutritional expert. And he somehow got onto the Joe Rogan show and slandered the Game Changers, making all these accusations about it, that it's not scientific, that the studies were cherry-picked, yada, yada, yada. Amazingly, Joe invited James Wilkes on, who's the producer of the Game Changers, to refute these alleged debunks. And James came on and spoke for 4 hours on this matter and absolutely slayed Chris Cresser at every point. He clearly pointed out how and where Chris was wrong and completely sharing false information. Now, if you guys want a breakdown on this, please check out Happy Healthy Vegan. Ryan Lum has been a legend at taking the key pieces of that conversation out and pointing out the fallacies and the mistakes and the downright lies Chris Cresser elucidates in the commentary. So it was just great to watch. And it's great to see someone like James, who's not a doctor or nutritionist or anything. He's a fighter. But he really went in there fighting.
Yeah.
And he was really well rehearsed and planned. He had a PowerPoint of like over 100 slides. He had all the studies mapped out, and he showed with simple mathematics that Chris did not know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And this should be a warning to media people out there. Don't invite people on to debunk something that's scientific if they're not a scientist or a doctor or a nutritionist. You are potentially misleading millions of people away from information that could potentially save their lives. People, I think Dr. Esselstyn said, I can't remember, someone said, one of the big doctors said, people like to hear good things about their bad habits.
Yeah.
And that is what these people do. They come on and they say, no, butter's fine. No, saturated fat is fine. It's not. And there's science to back it up. And these people can come on and claim they've debunked Game Changers and they've debunked Cowspiracy and they've debunked the China study. But they're just misusing these words, and they're also misinterpreting and misrepresenting the studies and the facts. So, yeah, that's what I have to say about it.
I think this word debunking has become the biggest clickbait word title of our time, which is unfortunate because, like you said, it is disregarding reality a lot of times. Now, it does work when someone like, you know, like Jamie Wilkes debunked Chris Cresser's debunking of Game Changers. So it might have worked in his favor, but we're in a period of our life where diets are in the biggest war. You know, it's the carnivores versus the vegans versus the in-betweens of keto, paleo, plant-based, whatever the case is. But when you get a documentary like Game Changers, that is the first documentary to ever been accepted to the U.S. Defense Force, then you have to ask yourself a question. They had, I think, over 100 PhD doctors on there reviewing it, and then they only reviewing it for the science and to make stronger soldiers.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm very glad that he went in like a fighter and he was meticulous.
He was.
Just almost like
relentless. He spoke for 80% of the time. Obviously, it was all about him, you know, refuting the.
But he controlled the podcast.
He did, yeah.
Joe Rogan couldn't even say anything.
No.
He could have mediated a bit better.
He could have. Joe didn't moderate that well, I don't think. He did. It's the first 2 hours, they meandered all over the place. But thanks to Ryan Lum from Happy Healthy Vegan, Ryan really pulls out the key things, the topic of B12, focused on protein, you know, and ultimately at the end, and this is what was incredible, is that James at the end put a post on Instagram to his audience and everywhere else and said, James absolutely smashed it, and I'm actually thinking about taking down Chris's episode. And he's never done that before.
Yeah.
Because he's realized that Chris was talking out his ass.
Mm. Well, you could actually hear in the podcast how Joe Rogan's idea on plant-based diets changed.
It has changed. He said a couple of days ago he now believes that people can be healthy on a plant-based diet. He's never said that publicly before.
That's big.
Yeah,
he's got a huge following.
It is huge. Yeah. So now meat in his mind is a choice, not a necessity, because that is what we're trying to teach people, us plant-based advocates. Yes, you could eat a little bit of meat, and yes, the difference between 95% and 100% plant-based is negligible. Yeah. Yes, you could eat 95% plants and 5% meat, and you'll be fine probably and be healthy. But we're saying you don't need that 5%. Mm. Why eat that extra 5%? It's just for taste. It's just for pleasure. Mm. With everything you know about the damage animal agriculture is having to our planet, drop the 5% and focus all the energy on plant and whole foods.
Yeah, of course. And what James said in the podcast, which really stood out to me, it was probably the biggest point, was everyone says, well, I'm on a plant-based diet. People that are eating eggs and meat, etc., still and have lots of vegetables. But what he was saying is a plant-based diet is majority of your calories, not the volume on your plate, coming from plants.
Mm.
And I think that throws a lot of people off. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of people out there that just have spinach and eggs, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, you got to eat the rainbow. You know, we need to get those complete proteins. Mm. You can't just eat chips and Oreos and drink Coke and think, oh, I tried vegan once and then I got sick. Well, duh.
Yeah. I feel a lot of the vegan movement is there, but they're not arguing on health. I mean, someone like Henya Mania, she's biggest vegan activist, but she's not in really for the health. She's in it for the animals.
Yeah.
This is where I want to get your viewpoint. Mm. I think a lot of people understand the health aspects of a plant-based diet now, I believe. What disservice are we doing to animals following a traditional Western diet?
What disservice?
Because I asked this question because there's going to be some listeners that refuse to watch Earthlings. That they go buy their meat in packages on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go into the back where animals are being killed. And perhaps briefly explain what is happening behind the scenes. And
I mean, where to begin is, let's take pigs, for example. Pigs are reared, 97% of pigs are factory farmed. So when you buy your bacon from a supermarket or your pork chops, 97% of those animals have been reared in the dark in a tiny little pen. Mother pigs are kept in farrowing crates, which is probably the size of, I'm trying to think how big it'd be in comparison to a human. Probably just a little bit bigger than a coffin. Can you imagine being in that for 70 days at a time with your babies strewn around you where you can't move, you can't see them, you can't stand up because you're so overweight from essentially being force-fed food and you're kept in there day in and day out. This is the brutality of factory farming. Animals who are not able to live their natural lives and experience the world in the way they would in the wild. They have that taken from them. And they're often also killed very, very young as well. Most farmed animals are killed within the kind of, you could say, the childhood years of their lives. Mm-hmm. Cows, for example, are reared, forcibly impregnated so that we can keep taking their milk. That is a process that happens over and over and over again. Cows can live until they're 25, some even 30 years, but most cows are killed around the age of 5 years. They're babies, but they're forcibly impregnated over and over and over again, have their babies taken away every time, and they cry for their babies for days and days and days, and they're tortured. Animals are absolutely, on farms, animals are absolutely tortured by human beings. And the farmers cry and say, this is our livelihood, this is our life, you're taken away from us. And that may be the case, but we now know that we don't have to eat animals to be healthy and to survive. So why are we doing this to animals? We're doing it for money. Mm. We're doing it for profit. We're doing it for pleasure, and we're doing it for gluttony. That's all we're doing it for. Most of the world. Some people in the world, I would argue, have to rely on animals because there's nothing else. There may be no crops, but that's a 0.00001% of the population. Because people always bring that up. They say, oh, what about the indigenous people of such and such country? But they're a tiny, minuscule amount of human beings. Most of us who live in the modern world have access to food from supermarkets where animals are factory farmed. Mm. And the animals behind those doors that you don't see are brutally and violently killed often. Slaughterhouses, Morrissey said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be vegetarian. Mm-hmm. Because people are innately kind and compassionate beings. No one wants to see inside a slaughterhouse. No one wants to see animals killed and brutally stabbed and boiled alive. Pigs are often boiled alive, for example. That's another horrific thing with pigs. They are stunned with an electric prodder they put in the forehead of the pig. It stuns them and they kind of fall over. I think a lot of people think that kills them. It doesn't. It stuns them. Mm. A lot of the time they're conscious. They get strung up by the neck with a hook and hung upside down. Sometimes they wake up while they're hanging and then end up being dropped in this boiling kind of pit of water. So they have their skin removed. So they're boiled alive. Cows often are put inside a machine when they're killed, where they slice their neck and they're supposed to be stunned, and they obviously are not. And animals bleed out, often conscious. There's chickens and there's rabbits and there's ducks and there's turkeys, and all these animals all experience similar things. Mm. Confinement, violent deaths, being pumped full of antibiotics. There's so much abuse and misuse of these beings on a daily basis. It's almost... For me, sometimes I describe it as a tsunami of death and despair. Mm. You know, the collective karma that humanity is creating by the way we treat animals, there are no words to describe how I feel about it.
I always say, if I look at the human race as a whole, not everyone, like just generally speaking, because generally speaking, not everyone's vegan yet. We've kind of used our intellect to degrade ourselves as a species.
Yeah.
We're taking advantage of other beings. And all of a sudden we've gained the superiority that, well, they don't feel as much pain, you know. Mm. It starts with fish, you know, like fish don't feel pain, pigs don't feel as much pain. Well, we raise them to be food, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very hard to get into someone's mind if they haven't seen it, because we've just been conditioned for so long. Mm-hmm. How do you deal in situations if you're at a table with non-vegans and they are quite aggressive on their points and they don't want to hear it, etc.? How do you deal with that?
I mean, most of the time I avoid it at dinner time because when you discuss people's food habits over food, people feel very threatened. So I tend to not discuss it over dinner. If someone pushed me, I would probably talk about the companion animals, cats and dogs. Mm. And I would ask someone to imagine holding their dog down and slicing its throat. How would you feel? I'd ask them to visualize that. Your dog that you love. Could you imagine standing on top of it, stabbing it in the neck and letting it bleed out all over your kitchen table? Would you do that? And most people wouldn't, and they'd be horrified by that. I talk about going for dinner with friends and serving a delicious stew and everyone enjoying the stew and someone asking, what's the recipe of the stew? And I say, oh, it's sage and it's beans and it's, you know, half a pound of Labrador. And, you know, they would go... How would your friends react if you said you were serving up half a pound of Labrador in this beef in this stew? Mm. Most people would react in horror, and I would ask them why. What's the difference between a dog and a cow, or a pig and a chicken? They're all living, feeling, thinking, dreaming creatures like you, like your dog, like your cat. Why do you love your cat? Wear your cow and eat your pig. Mm. You know, like as Dr. Melanie Joy says, people have created, human beings have created the paradigm of carnism, which is the opposite to veganism. Veganism is the counterculture to carnism. We are taught from children that eating meat is normal, needed, and necessary, and sometimes nice, that we have to have it, otherwise we'll die. And we know now that that's a lie. Mm. So I try and talk through people, talk this through with people, try and get into the psychology of why we eat meat. So not point the finger and say you're evil because you eat meat, or try and shame people. I'm trying to help them understand that they have been tricked into a mind maze of beliefs. It's a belief system. They don't think that they have a belief system. Mm. They're looking at me and they say, you're shoving your belief system down my throat, even though I haven't said anything. They don't realize that they exist within their own belief system.
Yeah.
And it's dismantling that and giving it a name and pointing a finger at it that helps people see it for what it really is.
Giving people a point of reference that really resonates with themselves.
Yeah.
Because like if you're in China, you can really give the, again, generally speaking, if you're in China, a lot of Chinese eat cats and dogs as well.
Yeah.
So you'd have to give some other explanation.
Well, surprisingly, not necessarily. I mean, it's quite a small plot. The places that eat cats and dogs is actually a very small part of China. Like most Chinese people are against eating cats and dogs.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a very...
It's a very niche.
What is the reason they're eating it? Is it?
So it's a festival. The Yulin Festival is a part of China, and they eat the dogs and cats out of tradition, but it's just become a bit of like a gluttonous festival. They also believe that the more pain the animal experiences, the better the meat tastes.
Okay.
And that has just come from like gossip and rumor. Like people, they've created the rumor. Somehow the rumor has become local tradition or ritual that, you know, when you torture the animal, the meat tastes way better.
Broken telephone, eh?
Wow. Yeah, right.
How many animals are being tortured and killed every year?
I know this number and I've completely forgotten it. it's in the trillions. When you think about fish, it's hundreds of trillions of individuals, hundreds of trillions. When you talk about fish specifically, we don't even talk about them as individuals. We call them fish, not fishes.
Mm.
We use a collective noun that doesn't even talk about them as individuals. There's actually a website that can help you with this number. It's called the Animal Kill Counter. And the Animal Kill Counter has all the numbers that you can see on how many chickens, cows, pigs, fish, ducks, geese, turkeys, horses, snakes, camels are killed every second.
Yeah.
And it gives you an idea of just the volume of which humans are killing.
Mm. And there's a for listeners, there's a countdown timer and counter. If you go on the website, for as long as you're on the website, it gives you how many animals are being killed in lifetime.
Yeah.
Why are people unable to relate to farm animals and fish particularly? Where is that blockage?
People are unable to relate to fish because they don't show personality on their face. They don't cry. They don't scream. They don't blink. Most mammals blink when they look at us. It gives them personality. Dogs appear to smile when we look at them, so we anthropomorphize our emotions onto them. People don't identify with farm animals because they never see them. They're locked behind factory walls and hidden in farms with high gates and walls. People don't see them. That's why they don't relate to them. But any person who's been to a sanctuary and spent any time with a pig or a turkey or a rooster or a goose, these animals, when they trust human beings and they become close to them, they're the most loving, gentle creatures. Cows are the most beautiful, gentle creatures. This is why we've been able to enslave them, because they are passive, gentle, and childlike beings. They're like children. They have many of them have the mental capacity of small human beings, like as in children. Pigs have the mental capacity of a 3 or 4 year old human being. They can problem solve. They can open doors. They can think for themselves. They can find ways out of mazes. They're smart. They're intelligent. They see the world like we do. They see the world in color. Cows have best friends. And when they're in a herd, cows have best friends that they hang out with, that they only spend time with, That's the sadness that I feel when I look at these animals. I think they're not being given the opportunity to be who they really are. And people say, what would happen to all the animals if human beings stopped eating them? I'm like, well, maybe they might actually get to live normal lives.
Yeah, roam around.
And be free and be in natural numbers, not in the trillions that we breed them into existence now just so that we can kill them.
And they would die and live their natural life,
which
they miss out on
year
over year over year.
Yeah.
It's always a very sore point, like listening to this kind of information again, because I always ask the question, when is majority of the world going to change? I like to think that we're in the process of this happening. I'm not sure if it is viable to even think that human beings will 100% change.
I don't think we will.
Yeah.
I think we're dreaming, unfortunately. I'd like to be positive about it, but I don't think people will. I think the system that we live in at the moment is built to encourage selfishness and self-centeredness and short-terminism. The entire economic system that we exist within doesn't teach us to collaborate. It doesn't teach us to be compassionate. Mm-hmm. It doesn't teach us to be kind to others. It teaches us to think for ourselves, to be out for ourselves, to compete with others, to be on top, to be the best, to be number one. It doesn't teach us compassion. It doesn't train us. If we can change the economic system, the schooling system, the finance system, things will change. But until that happens, I don't think it will. I think, you know, with the whole breakdown and rebuild analogy, I think human society needs to crumble and be destroyed, and a few human beings left for us to go, we need to rebuild this.
Yeah.
Like a war. And often, in a way, wars serve a purpose. They destroy everything and then you rebuild a better city, a stronger city, more resilient city. Most of London was destroyed in the Second World War with the bombings, and it came back a bigger, stronger, more vibrant, beautiful city. And that's the nature of the universe. Life and death, creation and destruction, everything is temporary. And I think for a new human society to be built, and, you know, let's be honest, human beings in our current form, and that's not even modern humans, we've only been around 200,000 years.
Yeah.
Our current existence is infinitesimally small. That's a big word. You know, we're just a blip in the eye of the universe. So for us just to reset is nothing, really. And I hope that will happen. I hope that everything goes and we have an opportunity to recreate our society in a completely new way. But it's coming. I think the climate breakdown, which a lot of people think is some kind of Chinese hoax, is coming. The permafrost and the ice caps are melting. It is melting. And the methane being released is going to cause a global catastrophic shift in weather systems that is going to change the shape and face of the planet. Our modern society, our intercontinental flights, they will stop, and we'll have violent weather systems that may go on for months. If anyone has watched The Day After Tomorrow, where there's these superstorms that happen, and literally the earth freezes and you just get ice everywhere. I'm not saying we'll get that, but we're going to get violent weather systems that will disrupt entire countries permanently.
Winter's coming.
Yeah. Jon Snow, where are you?
It's scary. It's scary because we also don't know if it's just around the corner or if it's...
It is just around the corner.
Yeah.
It is just around the corner. We've known about this for over 100 years.
Yeah.
Men were standing on stages in London at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, watching the smoke billow into the atmosphere. Men of science and... you know, you could say early environmentalists, warning that this kind of lifestyle, this creation of infinite wealth, all these things would have a catastrophic effect. People with foresight to see into the future, maybe people who are clairvoyant, who knows, who said danger is coming. And they were laughed at. They were told that they were ridiculous and they should shut up and go away. And that's been going on for over almost 100 years. Well, more than 100 years, actually, from early 1900s to the 2000s and now into the new century. People are still laughing at us, and we're saying, I always like to use the analogy of a bus. Earth is like a bus, it's full of people having a party. At the back are the ethical vegans and ethical environmentalists who are hopefully vegan, shouting, slow down, we need to stop the bus. And people in the front are partying and singing and dancing, throwing plastic out the window, drinking what they want, eating what they want, buying as much as they want, and just the bus is just hurtling along towards a cliff. And we are saying stop, and everyone's laughing at us saying, no, this is party. We only live once. It's great. Party, party, party. Come join us. And the occasional ethical vegan is going, fuck it, and is joining them at the front of the bus. But people are crying for the bus to stop, and it's just not stopping. And we know that the edge is coming. The cliff is coming. What will be left, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll turn
it around. Hopefully.
Maybe we will turn it around. Maybe some incredible person will invent some kind of device that can suck these gases out of the atmosphere quick enough. Who knows?
Mm. We can only hope. We can hope and pray every single day, and we can also take action, exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
I applaud you, what you are doing.
Thank you. We got to keep at it. You know, the point is that if we can get enough people to make a change, then there's always hope. Like, I do have hope. I mean, might sound like a prophet of doom recounting those analogies, but I think ultimately, as long as there are people who are trying to turn the bus around, there's still hope. You know, when the last person at the back of the bus gives up and joins the party, then we're fucked.
Or we just change the driver to an ethical vegan.
yeah, turn it around, go back the other way.
That's amazing. Okay, so I end off every podcast with some 5 power questions.
Okay.
So let's hit them. Number 1, what do you think the soul is?
What do I think the soul is? That's a very good question. I think the soul is an anchor that maintains our existence within the three-dimensional world. It is something that keeps us in this space. It's something that gives us our personality, our identity. But the moment we leave this physical realm, our soul disconnects from it and returns to the great lake of consciousness.
Beautiful. 2, what's your definition of God?
My definition of God, God is, and all that is God, and everything else that exists within God and under the umbrella of all creation and religion is us, and everything is God as well, and is God as well.
3, complete the sentence, the world needs?
The world needs more love.
What is the purpose of the human experience?
The purpose of the human experience is to experience love and pain and joy and suffering and jealousy and anger and misery and death.
How important is human connection and why?
Human connection is the most important thing that we can have as beings, because it gives us an opportunity to understand ourselves better.
Robbie, thank you so much. These last 45 minutes have been
my pleasure.
Riveting, to quote some movie connoisseurs. But generally, what you've created in your own life, and influencing, just from the point of view of you influencing as Robbie Luckey, and you've taken a step further with Plant Based News, which is unbelievable.
Thank you.
I know a lot of non-vegans that have their eyes on Plant Based News,
and hopefully.
That time comes before they drive their bus off the end of the cliff.
Yeah.
And I think together, like you said, if we do things together, collaboratively, then I think we've got a chance.
Definitely. There's always hope.
It's hope. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we will see you next week for another beautiful episode with a different change maker. But for now, let this change maker's words sink in. And if you have any questions, reach out to me, or you can reach out to Robbie. What channels can people reach out to you?
On Instagram.
Great.
Twitter, and contact@plantbasednews.org.
Okay, great. I'll put all the links in the bio. Guys, check you next week.
It means so much to myself and my change-making friends that you decided to spend some of your valuable time with us. It would mean even more if you could share their inspiring message to your loved ones. As someone once told me, the only thing more powerful than changing the world every day for the good is doing it with a community. Guys, I love you, and I cannot wait to welcome you back next week. Remember to reach out to me directly at hello@garytirola.com if you have any questions, or hit me up on social media, Gary_Tirola, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm here for you, so let's do this together.